We're back. Back at it. Coming in hard hot.
1974
That's
Best
right.
Actor.
Let's finish this up. 1974 Best Actor category. This is Mike, Mike, and Oscar, episode 13.
Unbelievable.
The Dirty Company. Baker's Dozen, if you will.
Baker's Dozen.
That'd be a big Baker's Dozen, Bob. So last episode, we hit on the start of the 1974 Best Actor category, one of the most loaded categories in Academy Awards history.
We covered the heaviest stuff.
Hopefully. And now we're going to get you the angry stuff. So last episode, we gave you the year in review for 1974, the backdrop against which all these movies were seen. Big time of political turmoil and unrest. We also covered the performances of Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, one of the greatest performances ever. We covered the performance of Dustin Hoffman in Lenny.
Yes.
Despite what you think about, what you may think about the man, which you have every right to do, still one of the greatest performances ever in cinematic
history. We talked
about
it quite a bit.
It's both heavy movies, both heavy subject matter. We're going to start on a more lighter note for this one.
A trip to the Legoland.
Yeah, we're going straight to La La Land.
Albert Finney. I'm sorry. Kenneth Branagh taught me how to say it in the new movie. Hercule Poirot.
Let's skip this. Hercule Poirot, played by Albert Finney. Murder on the Orient Express. Go
Albert
ahead.
Pacino going. Yeah. Listen, Albert Finney was born in 1936 in Charlestown of Pendleton, England.
In a funhouse.
He must have been a star student in his drama school because after he graduates, they all come to him, baby. British theater and television jobs find him one after the next, starting to dislike him. But in Finney's first 5 years out of school, he works with Charles Laughton. He works with Laurence Olivier. Everybody's nodding right now because those are two names we're all supposed to recognize as movie buffs.
Mm.
And, of course, we're all lying.
Yes. Now,
I mean, Olivier Lawrence. We remember from Marathon Mare and Rebecca and Sleuth. Charles Laughton, though, I'm drawing a blank. I'm supposed to know who he is. I don't.
I think he's a defensive end for the Bengals.
Finney's breakthrough performance comes with Saturday Night and Sunday Morning in 1960, and 11 people have reviewed it on Rotten Tomatoes, and I think those are the only 11 people who have ever seen it. 100%er. 100%er.
This is what we talked about last episode. Don't live and die by the tomato meter. It's a great tool, but you can't live your life by it. Live your life by
11.
Us.
Yes. Give me the full scoop here. See, the Oscar-winning Tom Jones.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
That's awesome.
Are we talking about that one? Or
yes. No. The Oscar-winning Tom Jones, which, listen, was, you remember the artist from a few years ago? Well, this is the British version of The Artist, a silent movie.
Oh, good. So it's more pretentious.
A spooky Oscar pick. But here's the thing. 1963's Tom Jones wins Best Picture and nominates Finney as well. It's kind of a cool everyman setup because
he is
a Casanova, but he is a fat British guy in his early 30s.
So it's like us.
So it's like should be our hero. Anyway, my sources tell
minus
me
the success with females.
General lack of female attention over here. Anyway, Finney then eats himself out of his casting of David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia protagonist. I'm starting to like this guy now.
Chicken parm.
Finney spends the rest of his 30s, well, eating, but of course.
So he's exactly like us.
He's acting in his plays. We have a lot to look forward to. Portraying movie characters in their 40s or older. So this is kind of hits the theme of the movie we're going to talk about, Murder on the Orient Express. He is the same age as Dustin Hoffman and these other guys that are nominated that year, but he's playing a 65-year-old Frenchman.
Crazy. And he pulls it off, too.
Going back, rewinding for a second, he does 7 consecutive films. This, is, again, is after Tom Jones and...
Ta-da! Yeah.
Right. After Tom Jones, he does 7 consecutive films that have already become lost to all humankind, including Charlie Bubbles and Ebenezer... Mm. What's that character's name? In a movie called Scrooge.
Thought it was Phillips.
I suck at stick. Listen, I'm reading between the lines here, but... This dude looks like that other dude 35 years before. So, Ewan McGregor looks like Albert Finney.
This is one of the great Mike and Oscar conspiracy theories of all time coming up. Go ahead.
I don't know. I don't know who Ewan McGregor's real father was. I wasn't there in
the room. Haven't met?
I wasn't there in Scotland. But listen, you know, Ewan McGregor was Obi-Wan Kenobi in all those movies. We hate the Star Wars prequels, but he was also Fargo TV series. We loved him in Black Hawk Down. He's done a lot of good stuff since. He played Albert Finney, a younger version, in Big Fish. I, many times in Murder on the Orient Express, two rewatches, I'm like, oh my God, that's Ewan McGregor's face, just wrapped in a lot more fat.
So, what's your thesis?
They have to be related, right? I mean, I wasn't the only person to see this. Like I said,
Tim Burton, pulling back a little bit. Big Fish. Mike believes that Albert Finney is Ewan McGregor's father.
I'm pretty sure. It is a...
So Ancestry.com, if you're out there,
you can hit us up. I'm ruining lives in the McGregor household right now. And the Finney households.
Just forks dropping on plates as people...
How'd you know? Oh, my God. Anyway, getting back to it. 1970s, early 70s are happening somewhere. Albert Finney is with Mrs. McGregor. But yeah, I mean, he has a brief stint in Gotham City's Arkham Asylum, and then Finney is awarded the role of Hercule Poirot, or pronounced Poirot, in Murder on the Orient Express. That brings us up to date. I am going to jump ahead and finish his filmography. He comes to Hollywood after Murder on the Orient Express. He acts... And he meets John Huston. He acts in John Huston's Annie. He is Daddy Warbucks.
The son of God. This guy was made to play Daddy Warbucks, by the way.
Is he really? So I didn't see that one. Another Oscar-nominated role.
That's right. You've had a hard knock life.
Sir in the Dresser. Isn't that a Jay-Z song? Anyway, Sir in the Dresser, which is not a pun. That's a really good play, a really good movie remake.
What would that be a pun for? What are you talking about?
Sir in the Dresser. It's a linguistic puzzle. It's a play on words.
Is it dresser as in like...
It's funny when I wrote it down, but not funny when I say it to you, apparently.
I don't think you know what puns are.
The Dresser is 100% on the tomato meter. It's actually a pretty good remake starring Hannibal Lecter and Gandalf.
Oh, okay.
Anthony Hopkins.
Finally see that showdown.
Starring Shrock'em Sock'em and Pew. That's how I think. No, starring these two great actors, Anthony Hopkins and Ian McKellen. It was a Starz like original movie, the remake. It's really well done. I'm going to have to go and watch the original. I know it was like some play or something. Finney reteams with Huston for another Oscar nod in Under the Volcano in 1985. And then he stars as Leo in perhaps my favorite Coen Brothers supporting actor performance of all time in Miller's Crossing, one of my favorite Coen Brothers movies, period, one of my favorite movies of the 80s. And since then, he's known for his roles in Simpatico, Aaron Brockovich, Traffic, The Bourne Ultimatum, Big Fish. And
a very established career. We're dealing with a serious guy here.
The role that should have been Sean Connery's in the newest, one of the newer James Bond films, Skyfall. They meant to give it to Connery, and it didn't happen. Murder on the Orient Express, going back 1974. The rewind button. Here we go.
Yeah, this is what Albert Finney got his nomination for. 1974 Best Actor nomination as Hercule Poirot. Murder on the Orient Express debuted November 21st of 74 in the UK, and it debuted stateside 11/24, so 3 days later. Written by Paul Dean, which is
written by Agatha Christie, first of all.
Yeah, all right.
Books are made
screenplay
into movies.
Written by Paul Dean. Not Paula Dean. There was no butter involved in the making of this film.
Or racial slurs.
Directed by Sidney Lumet. A $1.4 million budget, pretty much a shoestring budget, ended up grossing a $35.7 million gross. Good for the 11th highest grossing film of 74. 7.3 composite IMDb rating. 6 Oscar nominations on the night. It did take home 1 win. It was nominated for Best Music, Original Dramatic Score, Best Costume Design, Best Cinematography, Best Adapted Screenplay for the Agatha Christie novel, as Mike said. So pretentiously, Best Lead Actor for Albert Finney. The lone Oscar that it did win was Best Supporting Actress for Ingrid Bergman. Now, You heard Ingrid Bergman. That's a very famous person name. Albert Finney is a very, very famous person name.
The cast.
This cast. If incredible. You were famous in 1974, you were at least a bit player in this movie.
Jacqueline Bisset, Michael York, Basil Exposition. You have Ingrid Bergman, as you said. You have John Gielgud.
Vanessa Redgrave, Sean Connery, Anthony Perkins, Lauren Bacall.
Anthony Perkins is great in this. I'll be honest
Brad
with
Stevens.
You.
Anthony Perkins in this movie is Brad Stevens.
Yeah, he should play. He'll play
he looks
Brad.
Just like him.
He'll play Brad Stevens in a CG version of Anthony Perkins someday. When the actors no longer are needed. But here's the thing. Like, this movie, just the cast, unbelievable. And the remake. The cast in the remake is incredible. I'm going to be honest with you. This original was bizarre. I enjoyed the heck out of the remake.
And Mike's seen it, and I have it, and I was shocked, first of all, with the tonal shift between this 74 version and the remake that came out this year.
There's more tonal consistency in a remake, but here's the thing. This movie is very theatrical. Like it could have all been done on one stage, just two people talking to each other
was one of the points
in
I was
a car.
Gonna, this is a play.
It's a play, and it's a novel first, obviously. I don't know about you. I've only read one Agatha Christie novel. I had to read it for school. It was the one about the Nile. So I got the one reference at the end of the Murder on the Orient Express where they're like, oh, yeah, he's setting up the next movie. So it's gonna happen, too,
just
by the way.
Staring blankly at you.
It's going to happen because this movie's making money, Murder on the Orient Express.
It is. I'm surprised. I thought it was going to be a flop, but yeah.
Brenna! Yeah, I mean,
he's great, too.
He's great in the movie. John Gielgud's part of the butler is played by Derek Jacobi. Anyway, he's insanely good in a few scenes. Just blown up. British Shakespearean actor. The little things he's doing with his face. All the special effects in this movie. And they actually make it cinematic. And there's fights and there's crazy stuff. And there's just blow your mind shots of a train going through, you know, its express route. From the Orient. Unbelievable visuals in that movie. Just that mustache alone.
Best mustache in the lead role.
Best mustache in the lead role. The Mike Mica Men Oscar
Maybe that'll
Awards.
Be, yeah. That'll be when we give out. But anyway, Murder on the Orient.
Well, anyway, I've got to get back to Derek Jacobi. Just his facial expressions are the most impressive visual of that movie. The subtleties are just... I couldn't believe it. I'm watching this movie and the little things that man is doing with his face, one after another,
you're doing more for this movie than any commercial they have.
You had to be there.
So the 1974, like we said, it's a much more playful version, even though it's still serious subject matter. You're dealing with a murder on
this,
a train.
This movie has characters in it. That should belong on the cover of Monopoly.
Oh.
It's silly nonsense.
I mean, Albert Finney does. He's the Monopoly man in this
you
movie.
You have a James Bond set, right? And you have James Bond-like 1970s visuals. You have James Bond in the movie. It's just, you know...
Hanging out.
Scoffing and saying, stupid frog.
Overacting to the nth degree is Sean Connery in this movie.
With Vanessa Redgrave... But yeah, I mean, you have this absurdly beautiful scene at the beginning, and then you have a character of Hercule Poirot with his collar almost past his chin, just this most ridiculous visual, this no-neck turtle with a haircut that is painted with still wet paint over his head. The hair is just so gelled. And then you have his mustache with his drawn... Again, with oil paint on his face. It's just such a ridiculous character that both of us thought was the derivation of
Inspector
the Pink
Clouseau
Panther.
But it turns out, no.
Well, it still could be the novel. That's what I thought. Like, we're both dumb.
Well, the novel came out, obviously, well before the Pink Panther series. I thought
the novel came out
the Pink Panther character, the Peter Sellers character,
40s.
Was... a ripoff of this Albert Finney performance because this is what this movie is. It's Inspector Clouseau solving a murder in real life on a real train, right? Instead of this cartoon world that
Peter sells himself. For the first 20 minutes, you feel like this movie is a spoof. You're like, what the hell am I watching?
But no. In fact, the first Pink Panther movie came out well before, about over a decade before this, 1963.
It's such a crazy shift in yourself, in your own audience experience, because you go through watching the first 20 minutes of this movie and it's nonsense, and then all these actors start to just take the movie over. And one scene after
another. One way
another.
Or another, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but they're so good, they're so talented, you can't help but say, like, oh my God, these two actors are squaring off in this claustrophobic setting inside of a train. So there is some merit to this movie. It does happen. I don't agree with it as, like, one of Patton Oswalt's favorites. If you read Patton Oswalt's book, Silver Screen Fiend, it's kind of a cool listen on Audible. I enjoyed that recently. But, like, this is one of his favorite movies that he goes to watch every other night. It's so bizarre.
That is. That
he is a comedian.
That is a bizarre one, yeah. So to give you a little backdrop about what this movie is about, and if you don't know, if you have not seen the remake yet, Inspector Poirot is approached by a well-to-do wealthy man.
Inspector
Poirot.
Hercules Poirot?
Inspector Poirot is approached by a well-to-do wealthy man by the name of Ratchet.
The Hollywood foreign press like that.
on this train, this express train, who is worried that his life is in danger and begs for his protection, his being Poirot. After Poirot turns him down, Ratchet is found murdered, and Poirot, as a favor to his friend, the train line director, in order to keep the Yugoslavian police's noses out of the business of the train, decides to investigate the case.
Yugoslavian policeman.
And decides to investigate the murder on his own, and what follows next is a series of interviews where Finney's character has interviews with everyone who had any semblance of fame in the early 70s, as we said in this cast. Because they're all in this movie and they are all turned up to a 14.
Oh, yeah. Pretty awesome to watch all these eccentricities bounce off one another.
From the king of the eccentricity, which is Poirot, or Finney's character.
We're going to play each character with some version of a limp and an eye patch.
Yes.
Said Will Ferrell in the Woody Allen movie, Melinda and Melinda. I mean, this is really good writing. It is a derivation for a lot of murder mystery movies and books to come. One of my favorite movies of all time, well, the top 20, I won't say which, is based on this script format, which is really cool for me. And I reread articles about, you know, how that filmmaker based his newer movie on the older movie, so it's kind of weird how that works.
I get the feeling you enjoy this movie more than I did. There's holes in this, at least for me. I mean, there's a couple leaps in explanations. I know we're dealing with a... You get a whole backstory about this baby robbery, which is akin to the Lindbergh baby being kidnapped back in the 20s.
It's really...
Daisy Armstrong was the name of the baby who was taken in this movie, which has something to do with the plot.
So we talked about Chinatown having all this crazy backstory and shaping the world of the mystery and layering it. This movie does it in a prologue. Chinatown kind of layers it through. The new Murder on the Orient Express layers it through. And it's smartly done. It's very
cinematic.
That's
how I would prefer it to do. I
really prefer the new version. I mean, listen, the new version's a strong B86. It's not like an A movie or anything. But I was pleasantly surprised because I was expecting the worst.
Right.
So it's like one of those movies you got to check yourself. Like you feel
especially
good about
after
it.
Seeing this, because it was so, like, you know, there's some parts that are so off the wall. And like you said, eccentric is the word of the day for this movie. You kind of thought, I certainly thought that it was going to be the same kind of tone again. But
this has become one of the pillars of the detective genre, you know, in terms of the success of the novel and now the many adaptations of it. It is a story with a lot of bite, with a lot of edge to it that you wouldn't expect. You think you're dealing with this, you know, comedy of manners or this drama of manners, and you have all these verbal battles and sword fights.
It's a meeting of the minds, one trying to outwit the other.
And you got this murder that has some edge to the solution, I would just say. Is it you have this murder that has some edginess to it?
Yeah, I'm glad we're disagreeing because you're giving it more.
I can't say
grit
I can't
than I think
argue
there
my
is.
Point. I can't argue my point without giving away spoilers. That's
well, sure, and there's a lot to give away in this movie as well.
My hands are tied behind my back as Mike punching me in the face.
So let's just go into best scene, worst scene. I mean, that's the overall plot. A very eccentric man with a ridiculous mustache has to interview very eccentric people trying to solve this murder on this train.
Played that's by really good actors.
Yeah, that's what you do.
Very curious movie.
What was your best scene?
My best scene is the finale. Again, I can't really get into it. The way they finally made things cinematic.
It's Finney's Oscar reel scene.
Right, and it's his big Oscar reel scene, so they kind of weave in what's really happened as he explains what's happened. So that was very well done, and it's a scene that I stopped taking notes during because it just kind of blew me away and sucked me in. It was
I've been kind of deriding this movie a little bit during this review, but that scene is worth its money. It's
worth the price of admission in a way. I mean, it's kind of funny how you said Lenny's worth the watch because of the big scenes, and I kind of agreed with you reluctantly. And this movie, I'm kind of saying this, the opposite thing,
a little vice versa. That's what we did, a vice versa. No, I agree. It's that was my best scene as well. That's where the money is made in this movie. It's I don't know how it compares to the new one. Like I said, I haven't seen it, so I don't know if this the big crescendo scene in the new or the remake is as well done.
It's not essential to see in the theaters, maybe, but like when it comes out on VOD, I would probably recommend it. If you've seen this movie and you have something to compare it to,
right.
Obviously, if you're a fan of the books, and it's a whole other element.
My worst scene, like I said, I already alluded to it. The Sean Connery investigation, Sean Connery plays Colonel Arbuthnot.
It's awesome. My worst scene.
I just think Connery is so old. He think he either doesn't give a shit or he's trying to play a parody of himself. I think he's just overacting it to shit. And Finney's there, to his credit, trying to save it.
Because it could have been one of the better scenes.
Yeah, I totally agree. And Connery's got the chops, obviously.
Yeah, but it's so telegraphed what the characters are doing. He's manipulating the guy by yelling at his girlfriend. And it made me angry upon.
So you didn't like it because of Finney's role in it.
I didn't like the scene construction because you finally get a scene that's you're shooting more than just two people sitting down. You finally get a scene where you have the whole cart, the whole car. What do you call it in the train? You have the whole
caboose.
In full view. Wait, that didn't come out right.
Go on.
You have more to see. I'm still.
Keep going.
Still stepping in it.
It's just a giant ass analogy.
You have a lot to look at here. It's getting worse. It's some big visuals. Connery is on one side of the car, and you have Vanessa Redgrave on the other arguing with Albert Finney's character, Hercule, and you finally get different visuals than the rest of the movie, something the new version does a lot better job of giving you a variety of what you're looking at. I guess you can argue that this movie goes for the 12 Angry Men type of claustrophobia. I don't think it really works.
I didn't even get that kind of subtlety from it. I have a lot of problems with the scene. I don't know if it's because of the layout or because of the cinematography of it.
Finally get a different layout. You finally understand that you have Hercule Poirot, this great detective, pushing buttons.
Yeah.
You finally get some of those buttons, but they're telegraphed and it's just poorly done. All of that for that.
It's amazing. I mean, we see this movie very differently, but we had the same best and worst scene. That's pretty interesting.
And he says peep.
Yes. Instead of pipe. You have a big problem with
instead
that.
Instead of pipe.
This is a watch for you then.
It's still a watch for me. It's kind of cool to compare the two new movie and the old movie. I wonder if it's even, you know, cool to compare the novel to the adaptations. That could be fun. I may do an Audible or maybe a library audio book listen at some point. I don't know.
I'll say it's a watch if you're going to see the remake. Otherwise, you could pass on this for me. I'm not crazy about it. I don't think there's much that you're missing there. I mean, Finney's performance is good. I don't think I would nominate it. It's not my perfection.
Here's the thing about his performance that I forgot to mention. My favorite thing. I should have mentioned my favorite thing. He is a buffoon in terms of his appearance early on. They really pay that off or capitalize.
He's Columbo.
they capitalize off his silly nonsense look,
yeah,
because he plays people like a fiddle and they all underestimate him to their peril as he just dismantles them one by one in his interviews, as he proves himself to be the great detective at the end.
And there is a decent payoff in the ending, because even though you think he's pieced together everything, a decision is made by everyone to do something else with the information. It's
right, and
it's
the new movie even takes that to another level, which is cool. So,
yeah, like I said, if you're going to watch the new one, I would say watch this. Otherwise, for me, you could skip. Mike recommends it as watch. Mike's wrong. That's fine. Bring us to... You're not going to get a big review out of us for this one. You're going to get a lot of history, a lot of bio, and a lot of, my God, if you haven't seen this, what are you doing with your life? But The Godfather Part 2. Al Pacino getting nominated for his performance as Michael Corleone. He was nominated previously for his performance as Michael Corleone. He didn't win this one either. I hate everything. What do we have on Al Pacino?
Alfred James Pacino was born in a pot of Italian gravy, slow simmered. I'm sorry, I used that.
Him and De Niro were bobbing next to each other.
He was born in East Harlem, New York City in 1940. His parents divorced when he was just 2 years old, and he moved to the Bronx with his mother to live with his grandparents, who coincidentally hailed from a little town in Sicily called Corleone.
You trying to tell me that the Michael Corleone character, the guy that played it, was born in a town called Corleone?
His ancestors, grandparents, hailed from there, yes.
There is so much duality in this year's nominees. All right.
Pacino tries to be a baseball player as a kid, but his friends all nicknamed him the actor. I don't know if that he's, you know, pretending to get hit by pitches or if he just sucks as a baseball player.
But this may not be for you, Al.
He goes to a performing arts high school, but drops out at the age of 17. Alfredo leaves home, and he takes all kinds of low-paying jobs as a busboy, janitor, postal clerk, while he studies acting at the Herbert Berghoff School. He acts in a whole mess of plays, and eventually he earns himself a place at the famed Actors Studio in Hell's Kitchen.
Yes. Run by James Lipton.
Will Ferrell as James Lipton. Yes. Lee Strasberg's The Actors Studio. Pacino became a star student. He graduated and he wins a pair of Tony Awards. And then he gets his first role in 1969's Me, Natalie. Yada, yada, yada. More plays. And then somebody says, let's do Romeo and Juliet in New York City, but let's do it and make them junkies. A.K.A. The Panic in Needle Park.
Or Requiem for a Dream.
Alliteration again. He is seen by Francis Ford Coppola. He catches his eye in that performance.
Boy, isn't that fortunate!
Al was cast in the role of Michael Corleone in 1972's The Godfather over Jack Nicholson, Robert Redford, Warren Beatty, and Robert De Niro, famously getting the part over De Niro.
So, even though he didn't win this Best Actor category, he won a Best Actor category, beating out all those big names.
Insanely so. Those guys will be perennials in the nominations for years to come. But here's the craziest thing about this. He is the protagonist of The Godfather, which is a three-hour movie.
Correct.
And he is the Best Supporting Actor nominee.
Incorrect.
For 1972.
Something we hit on all the time. So this is the famous example.
We'll have to do that episode at some point.
They didn't want to rock the boat of the irritable Marlon Brando and let the kid outshine him.
Last week, Christoph Waltz has so much more screen time than Leonardo DiCaprio.
Christoph screws Leo out of his first Oscar in 2012.
Leo's the best lead. So weird. Mm-hmm. You have Marlon winning the Oscar and in the Best Actor category. Could have easily won the Best Supporting Actor.
Without question.
Maybe Michael Corleone wins the Best Actor. Again, this is kind of a Beast of No Nation, Idris Elba type of performance, to give you a recent example. Yeah. He's a nightmare of a character.
He is the devil. He is actually Satan in this movie.
He is a nightmare, yeah. So, 1974, The Godfather Part II. De Niro's actually cast in that movie as well. Serpico falls in between in 1973.
Definitely worth a watch, as well as the parody that Always Sunny in Philadelphia did of Serpico.
Yeah. Pacino's filmography, the rest of it is another stunner. Dog Day Afternoon, Godfather Part 3, say what you want about it. Pacino's still fabulous in it. Glenn Ross Oh, what
brass balls.
Heat, Donnie Brasco, the Devil's Advocate, which I can't wait to play during our Harry and Tonto review. The Insider, Insomnia. And honestly, recently, 2015's Danny Collins is one of my favorite performances.
Got a lot of love for that. Got a lot of love for his role as Dr. Kevorkian in the HBO movie.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very good. I missed that one.
Having a bit of a comeback.
Pacino wins.
As is De Niro, which we talked about last episode with the Silver Linings Playbook.
They kind of went through a major slump in the 2000s, but they've come roaring back. Pacino won his only Best Ass
Did have award. A great ass. I mean, we're going to put our cards on the table
his
here.
Best Actor Oscar. I can never say that. In 1993 for Scent of a Woman.
We should give a Best Ass Oscar.
Yeah. I was going to point to you,
CJ. Hoo-ah! Yeah,
he is also responsible.
That was just like primal yell. That wasn't even Pacino. That was just me exerting.
Al Pacino is also responsible for the forthcoming wall that Donald Trump is building because of his performances as Carlito's Way and Scarface. I'm right. Both released in the 1980s, Trump's formative years.
Yes, yes. So thank you, Al.
Oh, my God. Pacino's Best Tomato Meter performance came with The Godfather, which is at 99%.
Shocking.
Who are those two negative critics? 200 people reviewed it. Two negative reviews. What TF? Anyway,
it's not even, I mean, and I just read that Lady Bird is the greatest reviewed movie in Rotten Tomatoes history. That just happened.
Is it really?
It's not The Godfather Part 2.
Strong movie, but it's not 100%. Anyway, Robert De Niro's character from Copland should berate those two negative critics.
Go ahead.
What did you do?
Here we go.
You did something. What did you do?
Beautiful.
Did you eat my sandwich? Did you do it?
Best use of a sandwich in cinematic history.
As he's eating a sandwich, he's screaming at his employees. And that movie is pretty great. Yeah, man. Godfather Part 2.
Look, like I said at the start. Yeah.
D-E-A-U-X.
What are we going to tell you about Godfather Part 2 that you don't know? Admittedly, I'm at fault here because I went way too long in life without having seen the theatrical cut of this and Godfather 1. I didn't watch the through and through for the first time until the preparation for this podcast months ago when we first taped it. That's on me. That makes me a bad person. I deserve all the criticism in the world for that. Once you watch these movies, your life has changed. Your favorite movie list has changed. Your favorite performance list has changed. We'll get into all that at the end. But Godfather Part 2, Al Pacino as Michael Corleone, as Mike said, debuted December 12th, 1974. Novel written by Mario Puzo, who wrote the screenplay along with Francis Ford Coppola. Francis Ford Coppola directed. $13 million budget, grossed $47.5 million domestically, good for Paramount's highest grossing film of the year in 74, and was the sixth highest grossing film of 74 behind Blazing Saddles, The Towering Inferno, The Trial of Billy Jack, Young Frankenstein, and Earthquake. 11 Oscar nominations.
Hiccup?
Yeah, hiccup. 11 Oscar nominations, which led the field along with Chinatown, had 6 wins. Nominated for Best Costume Design, Best Supporting Actress for Talia Shire, Best Supporting Actor for Lee Strasberg, Best Supporting Actor for Michael Gazzo, and of course, Pacino for Lead Actor, where he lost to, again, Art Carney in A Cat. Pacino's nomination was his second first portrayal of Michael Corleone, made him at the time only the third actor ever to receive multiple nominations for playing the same character, a feat which has been achieved 6 times total up through today. Oscars the movie did win that night was Best Music Original Dramatic Score, which oddly enough, a lot of these movies, which were nominated for Best Actor, are also nominated for Best Music Original Dramatic Score. Best Art Direction Set
Sounds
Decoration.
Sounds like you see it.
Best Adapted Screenplay. Best Director. Best Supporting Actor in De Niro. Best Picture. Made even more amazing by the fact that the movie was shut out completely of any Golden Globe wins, which major oversight by them.
If going back to the score point, though, I fell asleep to Spotlight last night on Netflix. And what a score on that band.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, it's great score. So, yeah, I mean, it has something to do with it.
That was another year that had it. I mean, Spotlight was a great movie. Big Short, great movie.
Weird, but such a unique, classy...
Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton.
Great.
Boston accent.
A 9.0 IMDb rating on nearly 900,000 reviews, putting it at number 3 of their top 250 films of all time, behind only Shawshank and The Godfather Part 1. Aside from the numerous lists in which this movie sits at or near the top of, for example, it's number 7 in Entertainment Weekly's 100 Greatest Films Ever, Pacino's performance alone has been given special recognition. It was ranked 20th all-time in Premiere's 100 Greatest Acting Performances of All Time in 2006. It was number 4 on Total Film's 150 Greatest Performances of All Time in 2009. This is what we're dealing with. Arguably the greatest film and one of the greatest roles and performances in cinema history. I ask you again, what are we going to tell you about The Godfather Part 2 that you don't know?
You got to see this movie. I rewatched it twice for this podcast. I enjoyed every second of it. I think some, as an Italian-American, maybe I can add a few things. I wrote, I don't know, literally 4 term papers that I can remember during, you know, my film studies days at school on either The Godfather or The Godfather Part 2. It was just in my wheelhouse for many years there. There's a lot of interesting things to say about its portrayal of Italian-Americans, its resonance in the business community. You have...
It's at home for you, too. You're talking about your relationship with your grandfather. He knew a lot of these types of people.
Oh, yeah. He knew a lot of these people growing up. It's amazing how many upstanding Italian families go in different directions as you watch this person
exactly
become a
what
villain.
Happens here, yep.
And their prosperity just resorting to the level of violence that they show. Robert De Niro, Vito Corleone's backstory in this movie. It's very interesting to see how you have the sequel formula. If it's not established here, I don't think it is because you have sequels before this, it is reaffirmed. You have a great original movie, put a little twist on it, and remake it. And essentially, this saga continues from Mario Puzo's 2 books, the same way that the first one went, the same track, a little twist on it. Now you have the ultimate villain that everybody is in awe of, who's an anti-hero. It used to be Marlon Brando, it used to be the father, now it's the son. But you needed an origin story to mimic the plot of the first movie.
Exactly.
So you gave the origin story of the second movie to hit the same structural beats to Vito Corleone, who was in the first movie and not in the second movie, as Marlon Brando. So now you have Vito Corleone's origin story that really adds a lot.
In the same way that Lenny had a couple plot lines, a couple movies in one, in the same way, I mean, we talked about it during the Lenny review, where that movie had its shortcomings in trying to weave 2 plots together. The Godfather has 2 or 3 different plots. One is about the I don't know if you can call it a descent or an ascent by Michael Corleone into being the head of the family and being this evil
right.
operator. Also woven in that plot is Don Vito's upbringing, played by Robert De Niro, going back to Sicily and Italy in the 1920s and 30s.
One mesmerizing scene after the next. And Francis Ford Coppola, when he's at his best, he takes his time in every scene. And he builds up to the crescendos, and he builds up to the violence, and he really shows you. It's amazing to me how many, you know, wonderful Italian relishes he takes. He's showing the best that our culture has to offer. He wants you to taste the meatballs at the dinner table. He shows you all the wonderful family moments of you know, a big Italian Catholic family that everyone I'm related to grew up in. You have all these distinctly cultural pinnacles. I don't know what the words are to say in a podcast.
Benchmarks, hallmarks.
Yeah, you have the hallmarks of all these uniquely Italian. You celebrate the Italian culture, and yet you're showing the worst people in our culture. And it's crazy. You watch a movie like You've Got Mail. Talk about a rom-com. rom-com hate fest for you, Mike.
Yeah.
But indicative of how society views The Godfathers. Where are The Godfathers quoted the most? By businessmen in business industries. But you and I both lived in a college dorm. You quote these movies. You look up the business instincts according to The Godfather, business ethics according to The Godfather. It could be misconstrued quite a bit there, because here's Francis Ford Coppola showing the downfall of this businessman and all the principles that get him to where he is, and ultimately and coincidentally doom him at the same time. These are the businesses that our economy is based upon now, because everybody grew up watching this movie and went in 1,000 times in college and putting the posters on their wall. So I have a little rant. So you talked about adding something I tried to. I think that's true.
That's a fantastic
because,
point.
Because anyway, my point is, you've got male Tom Hanks quoting this movie.
And I did not think in our review of Godfather Part II we were going to be discussing Tom Hanks.
I've sat in business meetings where they quote The Godfather 1 and 2. This is the business we have chosen. You keep your enemies closer. And just talking about clients. You know, client doesn't like you. You got to stay close to your enemies. And these doom Michael Corleone in this fictional story. And yet we have many people operating in the business world according to these principles.
It's one of those definitely a benchmark movie in the way that the Lord of the Rings the first Lord of the Rings introduced the idea of movie universes and changed the way the blockbusters were made with practical effects and stuff like that. Argue that this movie, like you said, had a bigger impact on the world because, again, the grasp that it had and the places that it touches are outside the movie industry. And there's people that have been brought up. I mean, it certainly has shaped a lot of Italian-American families. My father's favorite quote is never two sides against the family. He's a guy that's 100% Polish.
Could this movie be made right now? Like, we have such a toxic environment where it's almost as if people are shying away from characters who do bad things. It's crazy. Like, we watched Battle of the Sexes. We reviewed it at the end of our first podcast, mm-hmm. right? It's almost as if distasteful characters become nominees that we don't want to vote for. And instead, and I tell you, if Emma Stone or if that movie gets nominated, it's just it's proving my point because that's a character without flaws.
Well, that's a half measure, yeah.
Say what you want about the true person, but everybody has flaws. Everybody's hypocritical to a degree.
Well, you may.
This is what I was trying to say in our movie news podcast. Nobody's going to react to the sexual harassment issues of the day perfectly. Nobody's going to act perfectly all the time. Simple as that. We all sin and fall short of the glory of God, said my Christian upbringing.
Well, let's play that out for a second before you. We don't want that out of context. We're not talking about. You know, we're not excusing saying nobody acts perfectly and that, oh, it's okay to lose your mind and sexually harass someone.
That's and
not
yet, okay. The characters in some of these movies are just these, like you said before, hallmarks of perfection and idealism. Mm-hmm. And it's just bullshit. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, that goes back to the stuff we keep beating that drum. I mean, that's why the real people get overlooked. And maybe it's why Michael Corleone character got overlooked by Harry and Tonto in this one. Because, you know, the Hollywood half measure, you know, they could fully embrace homosexuality as part of the culture in the early 2000s. They decided not to do that. They decided to embrace the extremely flawed movie that happens to talk about race in Crash instead. You know, right. I mean, they're not going to go all the way with stuff that should be done sometimes.
Yeah, I think that the Academy is so on edge right now because it's been under onslaught. I wouldn't be surprised if something like Battle of the Sexes was nominated. But here's the thing, again, to contrast it, you have Michael Corleone, who's one of the worst people the most ever. Despicable characters mm-hmm. of all time.
He's the worst.
He's also one of the more nuanced, what would they say, he has the most dimensions like a Hamlet because he does good things for his family at the same time. So you understand, and he's so capable. Like, something people love is a capable character. We've seen it in Hannibal Lecter. You can't help but respect Hannibal Lecter's level of brilliance and how he pulls off his escapes. Yeah, I mean, we said it about Roger Stone in the Netflix mm-hmm. episode. You know,
evil person, but I want to work for him.
Capability, brilliance. You admire those things. And it's just like a gasp every other scene with Michael Corleone in The Godfather Part II. But this is one of the most flawed characters whoever was drawn into a story, and yet you have Billie Jean King's Emma Stone, who's a character without a flaw, or her flaw is that she's a perfectionist.
Right.
And her flaw is the same flaw that all of us said in our first interviews getting out of college.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, this is what you're supposed to say to your interviewer.
Right.
Yeah, I'm a perfectionist. Yeah. No.
Not that I don't believe in your company's vision.
I have a terrible temper, and I do not suffer fools. No, yeah.
What would you say is your biggest weakness? I personally don't like you already. Yeah, no. I mean, you're making a lot of great points, and it's back to the Hollywood half measure conversation that we have over and over. I mean, is there a Michael Corleone character that could be up for best actor this year?
It's interesting that
best actress against the Emma Stone character, maybe
Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell for Three Billboards. I would say those are the getting close to it. Yeah, there's no Idris Elba necessarily yet that I've seen. But Frances McDormand.
Maybe Margot Robbie will be playing her portrayal of Tanya Harding. Yeah, interesting. That's coming out at the end of December. We'll see.
Interesting.
Godfather Part 2. If the only two cents I'll add about it, because I think Mike did a great job of doing the juxtaposition of why Hollywood is kind of missing the point here. But
thanks, buddy.
Yeah, I don't mean it. the only thing I'll add in is it's not just the Michael Corleone character that kind of makes this film what it is. And I know we're talking about the best acting performances, so it should be Al Pacino, but for as much as Michael Corleone establishes himself over the course of the two movies and re-identifies himself, the Robert Duvall character of Tom goes the opposite way. He's the strong, independent lawyer, and he just devolves into this sheepish man that kind of loses all sense of self.
I loved rewatch. I almost wanted to rewind those scenes between Tom and Michael, between Robert Duvall and Al Pacino. Because
just an undressing of a man.
Those series of scenes and how they... and how Michael acts entirely differently with Tom than he does with every other character in the movie. It's like his guard is down and he is finally can be honest.
Self, yep.
He finally can be himself with Tom, who is Michael's legitimacy. Tom's
supposed to be
job,
his conscious, yep. The family's conscious.
Tom's job is to make the family legitimate, and Michael has to hold him at arm's length. He still has to do the criminal, I am dominant, you are
and he ends
subservient
up stripping
thing.
Away, yep.
And yeah, he's
everything
still
about this man.
And then Tom calls him out for it. Tom's like, why are you acting this way with me? I am not some other thug that you have to intimidate, right? I am, why do you hurt me, Michael?
True. Are you asking me personally? No, you're absolutely. I mean, that's the take of it. Yeah.
Brilliant.
See The Godfather. See The Godfather Part 2. We could do best scene, worst scene. Go ahead. Best scene.
My other best scene, I had two. This was the series of scenes with Tom, but also the sequence of scenes between Michael and Fredo in Cuba. I originally had it where Michael and Fredo just go down and have some drinks. The cat and mouse, the relaxed, you know, posture of Michael as his brother just
and that's another
cringes.
Thing that makes this so brilliant. Pacino's career is him, the hoo-ahing and the overacting and the over-delivering, the caricature he's made of himself. This is such a pulled back and reserved performance in every aspect. You know, the worst things in the world are happening to this guy because he's made them happen, and he just takes it all in stride. He doesn't let his emotions get the best of him unless it deals with his direct family with the Diane Keaton scenes at the end where he loses his top, but
just
it's a nuance.
The predator, the predator that he is, and when you see him strike, obviously he strikes out at the most vulnerable character, Diane Keaton, his wife. Unbelievable how brilliant these writers are, both Puzo and obviously Francis Ford Coppola. In the first movie, he gains the whole world but loses his soul. In the second movie, he gains even more of the whole world and loses his family. And it's just incredible. And he actually gains the family in the first movie, right? He gains the family.
The control
of the family as the godfather. I'm using air quotes again that nobody can see. But
I don't smell right.
He doesn't lose his family at the end of the first Godfather. Again, if you haven't seen The Godfathers, I'm spoiling it a little bit with broad strokes. It's worth seeing. For all the minute details that are just brilliantly and layered one upon another, but he loses his family in the second movie.
and his feet
gains more business.
And you see just how far his reach is, too, at the end of the second movie.
Yeah.
He's, if you don't know, he ends up...
What do they say? We're bigger than Steel, U.S. Steel.
It's great. You see this movie. I didn't pick out a best scene because... the movie's just fantastic. And I realize that's a cop out, but I have a worst scene. I have the worst scene I have, and it's not even a worst scene, but I just think it under delivers in contrast to what it had to set up. Michael is being talked to by his mother after the fallout with Fredo happens down in Cuba, and Michael realizes what happened. His mother's trying to talk him out of saying family is all you have, and Michael's slyly explaining to her, well, times have changed. And
that mother's makeup is awkward in that scene because she is too young. Honestly, she is too young to be his mom. Like, she can't be that old.
Oh,
like, she's probably
maybe
in her
maybe she was a young Italian
early
woman.
Early 50s and And Pacino's like in his mid-30s.
Yeah. Well, maybe she had him at 15, 16, possibly.
Yeah, but then she...
I know in the flashback.
Something happens to her, but they had like awkward makeup.
I hear you.
That doesn't make sense.
So yeah, you have the practical problem with it like I did in Chinatown.
Right. It was a, you know, look behind the curtain there. Right. It was awkward.
Do you have a worse scene?
No, I mean, the scenes with Kay are electric. All the Fredo Michael stuff is just... This movie is a saga.
Yeah.
It's properly titled. It is a saga of greatness and you know, paradox. I mean, this movie shows the best of Italian culture and the worst of it. It's quite simply a drama to put on a pedestal.
So... Now that we've just talked about arguably the greatest performance and arguably the greatest movie of all time, I know you've been sticking around. This is the second episode. You might be a little fatigued by us at this point. Call your friends. Call your relatives. Tell them to put on the podcast starting at this point. Because you're going to hear me murder a man.
We're
going to
spoil.
I'm going to kill Mike. We're going to talk about Harry and Tonto, Art Carney. Ed Norton of the Honeymooners wins this category. You just heard us over two episodes gush about Hercule Poirot and Albert Finney. You heard us talk about Michael Corleone. You heard us talk about Jack Nicholson and J.J. Gitz. You heard us talk about Dustin Hoffman and putting on a heartbreaking performance. Lenny, none of that matters.
But Mike, he's feeding.
Shut the fuck up. Shut up! None of that matters. We're going to talk about Harry and Tonto. Art Carney going across the country. With his cat. Wins the category. Mike, what do we have on Art Carney?
So, Art Carney, born in 1918.
All right, you've said enough. Listen. Go ahead.
You're a jerk. Born in 1918 in Mount Vernon, New York. He's the youngest of six. He serves in WW2. So, everything Mike says is completely wrong.
Bashing war hero.
The pile of shit he just stepped in, folks. Because this man fought in the Battle of Normandy. He was wounded by shrapnel in his leg. He limps for the rest of his life. I'm playing a violin.
I'm going to assume he was just a spy.
He's making... It's going to make everything in Mike's speeches irrelevant and wrong.
Bashing a war hero.
Because this guy's a war hero. Go America.
Great man. Should have done this movie.
Listen, most of his early work came as a comedian, Art Carney, in a sketch and variety shows. But listen, legend has it. He gets his start on a little-known radio show in the 1940s called Art, Another Art, and Oscar. I'm sorry.
Go figure. Another joke for two?
No, he starts in radio. He makes his way to television, does some stuff on Broadway. I don't recognize the titles of any of these because this is early 40s stuff. So I apologize. I'm not going to list all this stuff that he acts in. There's only one television show I recognize. That is 1955's The Honeymooners, where he plays the role as Ed Norton, Jackie Gleason's head cheerleader / neighbor / best friend / chief enabler of domestic violence.
You
want to
talk about a show
jokes.
That doesn't age well.
Oh my God, pow, right in a kissa.
To the moon, Alice!
Do not rewatch
that. What do you mean I'm arrested?
Good God.
Yeah.
Especially in today's climate. Whoops. The Honeymooners airs for several seasons. Obviously, it's a humongous hit. It's an even bigger hit upon syndication. A lot more TV would follow for Art Carney, and he begins acting in TV movies in 1959. He even acts in two honest-to-goodness movies on the silver screen during that span, leading all the way up to 1974. But really, he comes out of nowhere for Harry and Tonto.
Yeah, I'll say.
To finish out his filmography, his highest rated on the tomato meter, The Muppets Take Manhattan.
Proper.
Proper. I waited for Mike
That's
to get it out.
That's his wheelhouse.
Because Mike started talking without words for the first 4 seconds of that. Anyway, Going in Style was a 90%er. And The Late Show, which I'm actually curious to watch. I like show business movies.
Yep.
100%er. Art's final film was Last Action Hero. Now, listen, last night I was supposed to be studying for this podcast, and instead I was watching clips of Last Action Hero on YouTube, one after the next. It's kind of funny, but here's the problem with that movie. Like
everything?
It didn't work. The reason why Last Action Hero was such a flop was because
I have not seen it since
it was
out,
supposed
so.
it was supposed to be like the celebration of all the awesomely bad Arnold Schwarzenegger-isms. But here's the thing, like the movie chuckles at you and says, hi, we're going to try to do something that's awesomely bad. You can't purposely do something that's awesomely bad and win the audience over.
I love these tangents we get off when we're talking about like the 1974 Best Actor and we talk about Last Action Hero and we're talking about 2012 Best Supporting Actor and we talk about Creed.
Anyway, I'm reading between the lines here, but I'm not wrong. When Art Carney sees Last Action Hero in 1993, Arnold calls him up and says, "Art, you have to see my movie. You're in the movie too. It's making no money, but you have to come to the premiere." Art sees the movie and dies on the spot. He died in 1993 when Last Action Hero came out, almost around the same time. Arnold sings to him like he's Tonto.
No. Oh, goodbye, babe.
You can make that joke because it's 24 years later. Anyway, sure. The end. Art Carney.
The end. All right. Well, that's what he did. Harry and Tonto.
Now Art Carney does to you.
Art Carney plays Harry. Movie was released August 12th, 1974.
We're going to spoil this.
Again, we're doing it at the end of the category because we're probably going to spoil this and I'm going to say shout some things. Written by Paul Mazursky, Josh Greenfeld, directed by Mazursky. Two Oscar nominations with one inexplicable win.
Mazursky hasn't done much else either. Moscow on the Hudson was kind of like a Robin Williams movie. Yeah.
Nominated for Best
You're Original validated a little bit.
Best there. Original Screenplay. And Art Carney won Best Lead Actor. An $880,000 budget. 7.5 IMDb rating. Everyone's wrong. Based on 4,100 plus user reviews, meaning there are 4,100 awful maniacs out there who enjoy self-mutilation and want to hurt me personally. Okay. Harry and Tonto is a movie about a man evicted from his apartment. Ends up going cross country with his cat. End scene.
Right.
We just basically orgasmed for 20, 25 minutes about the cultural and global impact
of
Michael Corleone, Al Pacino's performance.
Never mind the impact it had on the Hollywood industry.
We didn't even touch on that because it's known, it's understood. And I said that review was going to be short because we can't add much, though we tried.
We did.
Why did this win Best Actor?
You have three great performances splitting the vote of the 60%.
Let me inform
you on something. 60% majority.
If you need to give a Lifetime Achievement Award in this category for this year, which you shouldn't have because you have three of the greatest, even if you didn't know that this was like the impact that The Godfather would have had, which is stupid because obviously it did because the first one was already well done and established and was already making its legacy. Let's say you were numb to the idea of Pacino's performance. You have Hoffman and Lenny, which could have done it. You have Jack, who's already established himself as a mainline guy, putting on one of his more reserved and nuanced performance like we talked about in the last episode. Mm-hmm. If you needed to give a Lifetime performance away, why don't you go to Peter Falk in A Woman Under the Influence?
Yes.
He's on my perfecting profession too. Why don't you go to him, who was first nominated 14 years prior in 1960 for an Oscar, that who's never received one? Why do you have to go to this?
This feels like that movie, like Sylvester Stallone and Creed a couple years ago, where you have the narrative. You have the Oscar season narrative that a portion of the Academy falls in love with. And here's the thing. That portion of the Academy is a tick above the rest of the serious contingent who might have been 65%, who splits the vote between Chinatown's Jack, Lenny, Dustin Hoffman, and obviously Pacino. They split the serious vote. And then you have 30-something percent. By the numbers, you have 30-something percent that beats all of them by a hair.
I would like to know how many people in the Academy at the time had worked with or knew of or were at some point not related to literally, but were friends with Art Carney.
Listen,
because it had to be a group of old white men voting for an old white man.
I want to see the numbers on this movie. Because I want to see the Oscar votes. Because I think it's going to be like 37 to 20s and 30s.
I'm past the point of anger and rage. I'm just dejected
and
disappointed. Yeah. I'm so upset about this. Like, it's like, it's not like Rushmore. They needed a fourth face, but it was going to be the biggest face. And they're like, oh, let's put up like Dan Quayle. You know, like it's so insulting to movie history. And I hate, like, I love The Honeymooners, even though it doesn't age well. I watched it every New Year's, nursing a hangover, and every New Year day because they ran a marathon of it. Fuck!
You have Vince Carter from that great dunk contest.
Against Kobe Bryant.
Against and against, you know, the Dwight Howard just doing the really big jump backwards jam and throwing it down
hard. And Nate Robinson won.
Yeah, Nate Robinson. Or the little guy. Yeah, someone with like a gimmick for the contest. And yeah, Aaron Gordon does the, I jumped and I landed my butt on the top of the backboard and then I flew down and dunked the ball. And then, but yeah, Spud
Webb. So devil's advocate me. Go ahead. Where am I wrong?
Here's the thing. Like,
you're wrong.
This movie is not a grotesquely terrible movie. It is...
Mike!
It is...
This movie is about nothing!
An 84-85
B. Oh my God, no it isn't!
I'm going to argue it. And it also lives in the same genre of films that was made a lot at that time. Hal Ashby's...
That's fine.
Harold and Maude. It fits the not only the thematic road trip...
But it wasn't even one of the better ones of those...
I can argue for this movie's themes. I can argue for this movie's effectiveness. The problem is, this movie is, it's trying to infuriate you. It's trying to make you sad.
Well, it works.
So, it's a rough watch, and in very Manchester by the Sea style, which I hated with the passion of a thousand
yes,
suns.
Did.
And you loved.
Yeah, I
that,
did.
That movie is confrontational. And this movie's the same way. Now, Manchester by the Sea is confrontational, and even I reluctantly give it like a B+, A-. This movie doesn't have that high of a ceiling, so I'm not going to...
Oh, you think?
No. You hate it, and I think you hate it even more because of how great the other movies are, and I can't blame
you for that. But that's exactly why. Like,
I can't blame you for that.
The plot of this movie literally is a man gets evicted from his apartment. He's an old man. He doesn't want to become a burden on his children because he lives with them for a little bit, and he knows he's in the way, so he's trying to find his own way in life, and the only friend he has anymore is the cat Tonto because life is short and fleeting, and he's getting old and dealing with mortality.
Listen... Fine. His performance on the year is still probably top 15, top 10. I mean, I did all that out this morning trying to get...
But he doesn't do anything in this movie!
He
can't even show the requisite passion for the fucking cat who's his co-star!
But that's the...
And only partner in life.
That's the point of it. He is numb as a widower.
Fine. If he's numb, why is he banging prostitutes?
As a man who just... Well, that's perfectly...
But he's not!
He's numb... To his family and all the constant love that they're showing him. Here's the theme of the movie right here. You have a man that misdirects all of his affection onto this cat, correct?
But he doesn't! Yes, you're right. He should have, but he doesn't.
He sings to it even in its death's throes inside the...
Which, whatever. By the way, that cat needs to get its SAG card taken away.
But you have a man that's numb to all these this outpouring of affection. And it's really interesting to see this structure in a road trip movie. Because not only do you have his family who he meets up with, and you have sequences with his family members, right? You have sequence with his good, the good son, where he goes to live with first. You have and that family's a bit
I'm
of a hot mess.
I'm going to counterpoint you, but go ahead.
But you have a sequence where they're trying to pour affection on him and make him feel welcome. It's a bit of a hot mess, but at the same time, they want him. And they want him to engage in their family dynamic, even though it's messy. You have him going out to Chicago with Ellen Burstyn, who really acts that scene very well. You know, the nephew kind of meets up with them, and she wants him to stick around. You have him meeting all these, what Fight Club calls... single-serving friends who...
Ancillary characters, yeah.
Right, but who he interacts with, and each one of those characters are left wanting more from him. They want to hang out with him more. From the guy who he meets up with, the vitamin salesman,
Then why is his son so quick to kick him out of his house in the first 20 minutes? Not his own apartment, but the son, he goes to live with the son for a little bit, and they want him out of the house.
The wife wants him out of the house. That's messy. The his son fawns all over him to keep him around, and he even gives him money and he helps him around. And
he shows more affection towards his long lost girlfriend, who he by the way, goes on a road trip to track down at the request and a one-off from a 16-year-old vagabond.
Right.
Who basically says, oh, you should go find your girlfriend. And he's like, yeah, let's do that now. He shows more affection for finding her in the nursing home in her dementia state than he does for his life partner in this cat who he holds while it dies in his arms, basically.
It's the tragedy of the story. And it's tragic and it's in your face about it. And it's
but it's misplaced.
Gross. Yes, that's the point.
No, but it's misplaced in being misplaced. It's not correct. Like, I understand the idea of, like, okay, he's beloved by his family and he can't give back because he's an incapable man, but he pours all his emotions into this cat. Except he doesn't pour emotion into the cat.
Let's look at the last two scenes of the movie. The second to last scene, he is being offered residency by this single-serving friend he just met in California, by that old woman. She literally is so lonely and he's so lonely. She asks him to move in with him. They've just met. And yet he slimes his way out of that conversation and goes and follows another cat who he's displacing his potential relationship.
Because he's a fucking moron.
Because he's a fucking moron. Because he's a guy who does this. That's the tragedy of the whole story. He goes to try and get another cat to displace his affections and his relationships.
But this wasn't displacing affections in the first place. The cat was useless to him, essentially. I mean,
there's a whole argument to be had that our pets just have Stockholm syndrome. And they don't really love us. They would eat us if they had no other food.
I'm not arguing about the cat.
Cats in particular, they're disengaged predators that, oh my God, I'm not a cat person. We are, oh my God, nonchalant disengaged predators. I mean, everybody says save the cat in screenwriting world. Well, let's save the cat from the tree, right? That's the archetypal image.
Right.
What was the cat doing in the tree? It was eating baby birds. It was eating baby birds. And yet it's supposed to be the Good Samaritan move to steal the cat from the tree. Those cats are evil, man. Cats are evil. I'm a dog person, 100%.
And this is what you're defending.
I barely have a dog. I had to get passionate about something in this review.
You've just been hypocritical to yourself.
I had to get passionate about. I barely have a dog. I have a pug.
I love your dog. Stop it.
I like my dog.
I would go cross country with Cookie.
My Cookie, Wookie, Schmookie.
But see, I understand the argument you're making. I don't think it's pulled off correctly. And I don't think it's intentionally pulled off incorrectly. I think you're right about it being about loneliness and his obsession with it and his nonchalance towards his family, but it's supposed to be basically a buddy road trip movie. And for a guy that shows no affection towards loved ones, so you think he's numb to love and numb to passion, the decision is made to have him bang a prostitute randomly. The decision is made to have him get thrown in jail and
he's so emotionally numb that he bangs a prostitute. He's got all these people.
I would argue that you need to have him. Like, he has no outlet for his emotions. So it doesn't make sense.
That's the crescendo of his emotional numbness.
But it's not. If he was emotionally numb, if he wasn't feeling anything.
It's a crescendo.
If he wasn't feeling lost, he wouldn't give a shit.
Listen,
he wouldn't go hunting down his old girlfriend.
He's a widower. He's loved and lost. He mentions his dead wife many a times, right? This is a man so gun-shy of outpouring real affection on new people going through his late-life crisis.
Except he's not, because he takes in a 16-year-old vagabond, and he obviously values her opinion, and he bangs a prostitute, and he obviously wants to be friends with her, and he gets mad about being put in jail.
I see where you're arguing. I think we're both right in the sense that...
No, I am! I am!
But he...
Anyone that defends this movie is in the wrong!
He makes attempts at affection, but he doesn't follow through. He makes half-hearted attempts at affection with his family members, half-hearted attempts at affection with all these single-serving friends that you mentioned. But he never makes another long-term commitment with these people, except for with the cat, because that is an easy and safe thing to do. He doesn't really love the cat that much. It's a freaking cat. But he is burned and heartbroken and destroyed psychologically by the death of his wife. His sons have all kind of abandoned him for years. He's unnecessary as a teacher. There's no life for him professionally. His best friend just died. So this,
and he shows no
and
emotion.
He's kicked out of his home. So this man is emotionally numb. He literally walks the earth on
then
a road
why
trip.
Why do I give a shit about it? Then why does anyone give a shit about
because
it?
Because it's a senior life crisis movie. It's a movie about someone who's older and who is depressed about their entanglements and commitments and relationships.
Then show me he's depressed. Show me something.
Well, the irony of that, or the layeredness of it, it's one layer, but it has two layers, is that he's always singing and dancing. And yes, he's one of the more tragic figures in
you
movie
have
history.
You have such a scholastic
it's
and
not
like
one
a
of
scholarly
more tragic. Listen,
approach to this
again,
movie, and I'm just like yelling out in blind rage.
This
and
movie's a
B84, no,
which is
not.
Below average for me.
It's a terrible
I'm talking
movie.
About my
And never, let's not even touch on the fact that he has a 16-year-old just fucking get naked in the room with him, and it's totally cool.
Thank God she was 21. I remember pausing that movie, because she literally just tells him she's 15.
Yeah.
Pausing the movie, I'm just like, fuck. Looking it up, that she is 21.
Melanie Myron was the woman that played Ginger, who's the vagabond that Harry picks up and convinces him to go hunt down his
long-lost
love.
Worst scene of the movie for me, because he also diffuses that one with talking about how his recent view of her nudity
reminds him
of his long-lost love
what
when
is,
he was 16.
What redeemable quality does the screenwriting...
Then they go and visit her.
Does the acting, does the directorial choices have... I don't see any value in this. If you're telling me it's a movie about a tragic character who's trying to just get through life...
It's a tragic character who's misplacing his emotions and his affections.
But
it's a tragic character.
But if you're misplacing them, you have to put them somewhere. He doesn't put them anywhere.
He does put them for step one and step two in the meet and greet, and then in the help. He is a good Samaritan throughout that movie. So his first few steps, this is a polite man. This is a man who makes single-serving friends. But he doesn't go further. There's so far that he'll go. Like, and he can't take when shit gets real with his sons. He can't take.
And this just came to me. This is the Meyerowitz story is done wrong. This is because it's a normal guy going through his everyday shit and just how he deals with shit. But I don't give a shit about
structurally,
it.
Structurally, it's a tragedy. Structurally. So the Meyerowitz story
is
structurally
it?
Is a
how
comedy.
Is it a tragedy? He ends up having sex at his advanced age. He ends up getting out of jail at his advanced age. He ends up finding a new best friend at the end of the movie. So you just live on. It's not a tragedy.
It's 100% a tragedy because of all the things you just said. He is alone on a beach with some
stray cat.
But he's not
alone. He's alone because he fucking chooses to be alone.
He's alone
that's
on the beach.
Fault. That's
I
not
know.
My fault.
It's
Why
a
should
tragedy.
I be punished for it?
It's a tragedy because of his psychology.
Here's the best scene in the movie.
Things. He chooses to be alone. He chooses to be alone. What, you didn't like the Walking Dead at the beginning? All the actors who died 4 years
credits.
Before they
yeah.
filmed the movie?
Yeah, real glowing recommendation of New York City in the 70s.
As we stare at each other, awkward pause.
Just needed a deep. Yeah. Oh God, this movie sucked.
It's rough. It's not. It's and it, honestly,
how can you call it rough if you gave it a B though?
I gave it a B.
You're
well because
a fucking
I listen. I tried to explain it pretty well there. I think I did. I was an advocate for the.
No, you did fine, and I'm an ass, and I'm just
no.
Loud,
you're not. You're not.
I hate it.
You're not wrong to hate this movie. I'm just saying structurally it makes sense to me on the one hand. On the other hand,
so
all right, let's talk about his performance then, because
it's so misplaced. Everything is, if it wants to be the misplaced guy that wants affection or wants to put affection on something that isn't his family, show me the affection or show me a decision that he makes that has a ramification on him. Make him multifaceted.
Maybe,
he's one note.
Maybe misplaced is the wrong word. It's just he won't commit. This guy won't emotionally commit to anything.
Where is the depth in this character? There's no depth.
There's. What do you mean by death?
Like he just rolls. Like,
The character.
I don't want to say nothing affects him because you're going to say that's the point, and I get it, but it's done wrong. Like you can't have a guy where nothing affects him and life just keeps going on without having him face a speed bump. He faces his own mortality by seeing his best friend on the morgue table, and he's just like, yeah, that's him. Like, what the fuck?
No, he cries. He breaks down in that scene. Here's the thing. All the things you just mentioned, this guy reacts increasingly numb to. I would agree with that. He is emotional at the beginning of the movie, and it's interesting.
But he doesn't act like a numbed person.
he does in the cat scene where he just sings to the cat and it dies. He doesn't cry when the cat dies, when Tonto dies. You're 100% right, and it's just dawning on me now. He acts increasingly numb throughout this movie. The more shit gets real, the more he backs away from it. That's the tragedy I'm trying to get through. Obviously, it's infuriating to watch. This movie is infuriating to watch, and it has its flaws because, and in my opinion, it has some flaws, obviously, because it's not as rewatchable because 1974 was fucked up.
Yeah, I'll say.
16-year-olds taking their shirts off.
What'd you have for a best scene for this? I do have a best scene, believe it or not.
I kind of like the casino sequence because he plays a good drunk. It's kind of, you know, talk about disengaged America. What old people do.
It's another stupid scene.
They go to casinos every day instead of, you know.
Yeah, and I bet you a lot of them don't,
in the real world, they
don't
go to
piss on the glass.
Fantasy land. But casino is a fantasy land. It's a fantasy world. It's La La Land. It's supposed to be that. It's supposed to be that kind of oasis in the desert. So it's fitting that at the end of the movie, you know, his psychology and the setting kind of really mesh together. And that's.
Yeah, but the whole point of the casino is it's there so he can get arrested.
Get arrested.
In an absurd way. A way that no human being would ever act, especially not a senior citizen.
Right. And it kind of culminates the road trip, which goes backwards in American history. This is a typical road trip conventions where you end kind of all the friendships with an American Indian character going back in time.
Oh, my God. Cloning. Yeah, that.
That happens. That's a convention. That happens
in
a lot of road trip
fucking Indian
movies.
From Wayne's World.
At some point, yeah, they meet with an American Indian. When you're trying to say all this stuff about, you know, Americans in a political and cultural environment that coming out of the crazy 60s, you had your Nixonites, you had your hippies, you had everything in between. Road trip movies were happening a lot back then, and they were weird because of the landscape. And this movie does show that. But anyway, my best scene was Casino, kind of really some of his better acting in it, but also substantive in a way.
My best scene was the morgue scene, and I think that's his Oscar real scene, where he's, you know, got to put on the brave face and see his friend on the table, who he's just talking to a couple scenes prior, and blah, blah, blah.
His Sylvester Stallone crying scene, yeah.
Coming to grips with mortality. I mean, there are, I was going to say some positives, but maybe it's a positive for me in this movie, but that scene's a good one. But man, I just, literally, my worst scene, I have it all written in red. It's worst scene, this whole fucking movie. This cat has been nothing but an inconvenience and an afterthought. There's been no fucking deep-seated, heartwarming scenes where the cat actually means a lot to the owner, outside of Harry logging his ass everywhere. Not to mention he's supposed to look not so good, and he looks exactly the fucking same as he has the entire fucking movie. And then Harry just says, so long, kiddo. No big deal. I'll see you on the other side. What the fuck was this? Who was this for? What did this solve? What the fuck is the message after 2 hours of this shit? Jesus Christ, this sucked. So that's my review of Harry and Tonto. What's your worst scene?
My worst scene is the obviously the tone deafness
of the movie.
Of the 15-year-old girl getting naked for him scene. And
yeah,
how
that's tough to watch.
Give me a break. She's obviously, again, she's 22, 21. I think she was 22, actually, the actress. So it's
awkward to watch, yeah. All right, that's going to bring us to Perfecting Perfection. We'll run through it quick. Perfecting Perfection, as you know, we re-rank the top five nominees, and we give you a top five overall of what we think the...
Number one, Art Carney.
What the nominees should have been. I'll go first with the nominees, because I don't have a number five. I have a 8,491st. That's Art Carney for Harry and Tonto. This movie shouldn't have been made. I hate him. What do you got? Number five.
Number five, Art Carney. Yeah, it's still...
Goddamn right it is. Yeah.
Number four is Albert Finney. We
yeah,
both
of course,
have
yes.
5-4.
Again, it's three Titanic performances against two kind of off-base ones. What'd you have for number three?
Number three was it's a tough choice.
Oh, yeah, I would say so.
These three, and again, I thought they must have split the vote. I want to see the votes, because otherwise I'm going to totally...
Hollywood should release those. The Academy should release those.
Hollywood forever if they didn't vote it this way. But I think Jack Nicholson is my number three, as reluctant...
It's tough.
Tough choice.
Tough, but I have the same thing.
Wow.
Yeah, I think we're seeing eye to eye here. Number three is Jack, and it's
you're
only because
two?
Of the emotion. I felt more emotional connection to what Hoffman was emoting out of me. I put Hoffman at two.
just those two scenes in particular, mm-hmm. but obviously the versatility. And Nicholson has a lot of versatility in his performance as well. When you compare and contrast what he did in Chinatown and what he does in The Shining, or what he does in Chinatown and what he did in with McMurdy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the different types of charisma he has is absurd.
Hoffman wears more hats in his performance too.
Wears more hats, yeah. And those two scenes just break your heart and shatter it in a thousand pieces.
Oh my God!
What Harry and Tonto never could, which is why again my ceiling on those other movies are low. I'm breaking Mike's balls with The Devil's Advocacy, but yeah, I mean these three movies are
crash your car.
Far and away.
No, I mean, and it's even more striking in that we both think Lenny is an incredibly flawed movie. But this performance
right.
is just
right.
You
know, that is something to say yeah. for it. Yeah.
Number one, obviously,
Al Pacino.
I mean, how could you not? How could you not? It's one of the greatest performances in one of the greatest movies ever. It's the gold standard.
I was thinking about this. So perfecting perfection. Now we're gonna do our best on the year. I think our 1, 2, 3 stays the same.
Absolutely.
When we add all the yeah. snubs. So I want to go
for me. They're three of the greatest of all time.
I wanted to count upwards. Then 4, 5.
It's your world, man. Go for it.
If we can do that. So my number four was. So they were perfecting perfection. We're going on the whole year now.
Year of 1974.
I'm going to list, as an auctioneer style, the movies from that year. Airport 1975, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Scorsese movie, Benji, Blazing Saddles, Caged Heat, Chinatown, The Conversation with Gene Hackman, Death Wish, F for Fake, Orson Welles there, The Four Musketeers, Michael York, The Front Page, Matthau and Lemon, The Gambler, which my father tells me I have to see every week whenever I talk about, oh, you like movies?
I would like to go to a casino with your father,
should see
I feel
Gambler.
Like that would be a trip.
Yeah, we have fun. We lose money fast. The Godfather Part 2, obviously. Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. Gone in 60 Seconds, the original. Robert Redford, Great Gatsby. Harry and Tonto, Herbie Rides Again.
What was that one you said?
Little House on the Prairie, 1974. The Longest Yard, the Burt Reynolds version. Mame with Lucille Ball. The Man with the Golden Gun, a Bond movie. Mask of Zorro, Murder on the Orient Express. The Night Porter, The Odessa File. Parallax View. Spies Swept Away, The Sugarland Express, Taking a Pelham 1, 2, 3 to keep going with the train movies.
Which I thought was a John Carpenter film, but it's not.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I suck as an auctioneer. That's Entertainment, Thieves Like Us, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, The Towering Inferno, A Woman Under the Influence, John Cassavetes, Young Frankenstein, The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, and The Trials of Billy Jack were 2 and 4 in the best box office of the year. Francois Truffaut's Day for Night, Claudine, and Fellini's Amarcord.
Yeah, big year. Big year for comedy. Still Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, too.
I'm going epics. There with my number four.
Yeah,
man.
Go for
Gene
it.
Gene Wilder, number four with a bullet. Doesn't get
no
enough
kidding.
Credit.
Yeah, good for you.
Doesn't get enough credit for that performance because half of it's as the straight man. The other half of it is as this, you know, this goofy, you know, guy with all the shtick in the world. And he does play the protagonist. He does go for broke with the mad scientist persona in those Frankenstein scenes. I loved his performance in Young Frankenstein. It still kills me. It's funny as hell.
Yeah, I no qualms there. I mean, I'm glad to give comedy any kind of recognition anytime we can. These perfecting perfections turn you guys on to movies that you definitely should see that aren't nominated.
Number
four is Peter Falk. I alluded to it.
Right.
A Woman Under the Influence.
And her performance in that. Oh, my God.
Oh, she's nuts. She's nuts. I mean, I mean nuts in a good... I don't mean to...
Reminded me of Oprah yeah. Winfrey's performance this year in The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
I didn't see that, but you've been.
That's probably
that
the best acting performance yeah. on the year. If I mean, it's so over the top that you either like it or you don't. Probably
yeah.
some people might say, or maybe she's overacting.
But man, the emotions that Peter Falk runs through in this movie, trying to be just an everyday, you know, construction worker, trying to hold his family together. He's
in my top 10 for sure.
And he's the guy, I said it in the Harry and Tonto review. If you want to give a Lifetime Achievement Award, he was first nominated for an Oscar in 1960. All right,
wow.
It's 74 already. If you wanted to give it. This performance, I think, blows Harry and Tonto out of the water. But anyway.
What was your number five?
My number five was Gene Hackman in The Conversation.
Absolutely. Agreed.
Yeah, same.
Same,
yeah, good
same for
you.
Me.
Yeah, nice.
So I wanted to count 6 to 10 because
yeah, go for
I thought you would like that. So Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, The Front Page. I don't
that.
Know which one
I
of the
love
two.
Them.
It was a Golden Globe nominee, but for some reason didn't get Oscars. I still think Albert Finney and was very good. He was my 8.
It's a lot to it. It's
Peter Falk was my 7.
Okay.
But my number 9 was Mr. Whiskers and Pippins, the two cats who play Tonto and Harry and Tonto.
You fuck.
And then my number 10 was Art Carney. I figured you'd get a kick out of that. Joke for one.
It was a giant setup to throw pie at me. There you go. Perfecting perfection with a bullet, which is what I'm going to give Mike once this stops recording. 1974 Best Actor category, all wrapped up. Once again, Art Carney finished with the award on the night, winning Best Actor over three of the greatest performances of all time, along with another great performance by Albert Finney for Murder on the Orient Express. If you have not seen Chinatown, if you have not seen The Godfather Part 2, if you have not seen Lenny, definitely should worth a look. Mike likes the Murder on the Orient Express. I think if you're going to see the remake, which just came out this year, this past month, definitely check out the 74 version. I could not stay farther away from Harry and Tonto for the sake of you. Would you give that a watch or no?
No, I don't think it's that necessary.
Fair enough.
It's out of curiosity watch, maybe after listening to this podcast.
If you want to hate watch something, yeah.
Who do you agree with, Mike or me? I mean, that's somebody, I don't know.
So, again, you know, if you want to watch Harry and Tonto and tell me I was so wrong or tell Mike he was so wrong, which is the correct thing to do,
you can reach out to us. Enjoy it.
You reach out to us, once again, our social media. We are Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook. Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram. Check those out. Check Twitter out as well. We are MMO_pod. We post on those almost every single day, if not every day, multiple times. As much as we can, that's where you'll find the links to our shows. We're on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/Mike, Mike, and Oscar. And you can reach us. Questions, comments, concerns, something you want us to cover, something we haven't covered yet, something we have covered, you want to give us a compliment or deride us or make a joke or maybe send us some kind of information, whatever you want to do, mikemikeandoscar@gmail.com. Like we said, guys, we got a couple things in the fire. We're getting to this home stretch. This Oscar sprint after the holidays is what we're going to be concentrating on. So
we're super duper excited about the upcoming slate, what we're going to do for you with in terms of this Oscar sprint. We also got some retrospectives that we'll throw in. That'll be, you know, definitely, like we said, half of what we do most of the time, even though maybe we'll go a little more 2017 with the upcoming Oscar season. Really clicking into high gear December 12th when the Golden Globes are announced.
And so maybe we'll pull back on me yelling and swearing so much in future episodes, hopefully.
So we also just want to say, I mean, you're driving the bus in terms of, you know, helping us get the word out. So if you can tell a few friends or post something on your social media, it is a huge help to us. Of course, if you review us or rate us on iTunes or SoundCloud, that's a help as well.
We will send you cookies.
Yeah, we will come over and high five you.
Yeah, Mike's absolutely right, guys. We can't do this without you. We keep saying it over and over, but you are absolutely the force that makes this pony go. So,
but we're getting clicks from Germany. We're getting clicks from
Great Britain.
We are huge
in Europe. We are just giant in Europe. We're basically the Beatles. But, you know, we appreciate it. Absolutely. If you could share, tell your friends. Let us know what you think as well. Get the word out as much as you can. We really, truly appreciate it from the bottom of our hearts. And we're going to keep busting our asses for you and taking down movies and giving you what you should and shouldn't waste your time with.
A lot of free movie content coming. Because, Mike,
reality sucks. You should watch movies with us.
Watch movies.
See, that's like a tagline.
That's cool. We got it going.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you next time.
See ya.